following interview with William Layfield by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on April 29, 1987. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Office and the Foundation for Armenian Studies. Mr. Layfield, I have some questions about your background first. Where were you born and raised?
Born in Livingston, California, raised there, went through high school there.
Uh-huh. Where did you receive further education?
First I went into the U.S. Army for 3 years during the war. That's where I received a lot of education. And then after I got out, I went to Georgetown University School of Foreign Service for the purpose of getting in the diplomatic service, which I did started in 1950 as a diplomatic courier. Then went to United Nations Affairs and finally passed the Foreign Service exam in 52.
So you were at Georgetown in the late 40s, basically?
Yes, 47 to 50.
Uh-huh. Back to the war, where were you stationed during the war?
I was in the infantry in Europe.
Okay. Now, what were some of your diplomatic assignments during the 1950s?
I started out on loan to the aid program in Afghanistan. I was the only administrative support for the mission director, and at times I even acted as mission director.
Was that the International Cooperation Administration, ICA?
0.4.
Yeah. So that was the technical cooperation.
Right. TCA.
TCA, that's right. And after Afghanistan?
After Afghanistan, I moved on to Bilbao, Spain as vice consul and then consul, and then went to Harvard for graduate economic studies at the Litauer Center, the glove manufacturer, which is now the JFK School of Public Administration. And after that, I came to Washington to the Office of South Asian Affairs, where I was first on the India-Ceylon-Nepal desk and later on the Afghan-Pakistan desk.
What kind of work did you do? Was it like just general political and economic work?
I'm the last of the old-time generalists, I'm afraid. In South Asian Affairs, I was the political desk officer for Ceylon and Nepal and assistant for India. And then later I was the economic desk officer for Afghanistan and Pakistan. There was very little difference at that time. From there, I went to Argentina, to Buenos Aires as petroleum officer, where I stayed for about a year, then moved up country to a city called Cordoba, where the revolutions begin, and one almost started recently, to open a consulate.
This is in the early 60s or mid-60s?
Early 60s, mid-60s. I left there in 64. And came back to Washington as chief of Latin American personnel, which I did for a couple of years, and then moved on to Naples, Italy, as deputy principal officer. And what do you think that prepared me for? 5 years as economic counselor in Tehran.
I guess you have to be a generalist.
Right? Yep. Mm-hmm.
So what circumstances led to the assignment in Tehran? Is it your choice, or?
No, it was the farthest thing from my mind, but Nick Thatcher, who was the DCM, and Armin Meyer, who was the ambassador, both knew me, and since they, I guess, had a hard time finding anybody any better, they took me.
What time of the year was this?
This was in the summer of 69.
So as Meyer was leaving, actually, I guess.
Yeah, Meyer had actually departed by the time I got there. But Nick was there, and then Doug MacArthur came.
What were your general duties as economics?
Economic commercial counselor? Well, we still had the residuals of the aid program to work with and try to clean up. My then financial officer, the late Ed Prince, and I, along with Ambassador MacArthur, and the then head of the plan organization, Mehdi Sami, he lives in London now, did the last review of the Iranian economy that was called for by our U.S.-Iran agreements, aid agreements, and it was rather perfunctory by that time, because it was embarrassing to both of us. We had no aid program. We had no reason to meddle in their economy by then.
And who was the name of the plan organization official? I didn't quite catch it.
Mehdi Sami, S-A-M-I.
Okay. What other, after that task?
Reporting generally on the developments in the Iranian economy, I had a petroleum officer, a civil aviation officer, a financial officer, a whole raft of commercial officers, including a commercial attaché, and we tried to cover the waterfront.
Did your duties change over time, or were you?
Well, to the degree that we had no aid responsibilities, they did change. And to the degree that the commercial responsibilities were accented more, and we added a trade center in Tehran, they changed, but not markedly.
Division do any work on arms sales issues in terms of the economic aspects of arms sales?
To some degree, we did a good deal of analysis on debt service ratios, because in the early 70s, that was the hallmark of how much the nation could stand. We had a sort of a rule of thumb that if they used over 20% of their foreign exchange earnings to service their debt, then they were at the limit. Outside limit. Of course, those parameters have changed these days.
These arms sales were financed by Ex-Im Bank credits?
Ex-Im Bank credits, yeah. In those days, yeah.
Okay. Well, who were some of the people who worked in your offices? Who worked on petroleum issues, for example?
First, there was Bob Dowell, and then he was succeeded by John Washburn, who in turn was succeeded by David Patterson. And David was still there when I left the embassy in 74.
Who was the finance officer?
Finance officer first was Ed Prince, then Alex Rattray, who's now Consul General in Frankfurt, and he was succeeded by Walter Lundy, who is in African Affairs now. And Walter was the man when I left, but he in turn was succeeded by the fellow who's presently ambassador in Paraguay, and I can't remember his name, Jim something.
Did you have any Iranian nationals that worked for you?
Yes, we had we had two in the economic section, Gokshad Bakhtian and, what was the name of the other one? I guess the rest of them worked in the commercial section. Bakhtian was the only one who really worked for the economic section. The commercial section, we had Ismail Bulbadi, Ike Pirnazar, David Kashani, Mrs. Mikhailian, that's not quite right, but it's all Arpik and, oh my word, why did the last names look at them, but they won't right now.
But you had a number of nationals.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They worked, they did research jobs and other
research things. Jobs, yeah. On the commercial side, they did an active job in preparing WTDs. World Trade Directories, distributors lists, contact lists. They would oftentimes go out with American businessmen or just accompanying them on calls and serve as translators, although that was above and beyond the call of duty.
Now, besides the ambassador, leaving the ambassador aside for now, who are some of the influentials at the embassy outside the economic section?
Well, always, of course, the political counselor in the DCM, who in my first days there were Nick Thatcher, and the political counselor was Jack Armitage. They were in turn succeeded by Jack Miklos as DCM and Don Toussaint as political counselor, and later Andy Kilgore.
Do you know who the chief of Amish Mag was around that time?
Yes, Brigadier General, no, Major General Hamilton Putchell.
Oh, Putchell, he's still, okay, he was still there.
He was still there, and he was succeeded by Williamson, Butch Williamson, who in turn was succeeded by Rock Brett, no. No, Brett wasn't, Brett was Air Force. There was a bad spat patch in there, and there were some funny changes, but I can't remember the name right now.
I guess MacArthur was the person that's what he worked for.
Actually, yes.
What was he like to work for?
Unvarnished?
Yeah, as much as you, yeah, yeah, as far as you want to.
Actually, I got along with him very well. A lot of people did not. Partly because his competence in things economic was not well developed, let's say. And he relied on me to both for information gathering and for interpretation for his purposes. And he developed, it seemed to me, a good deal of confidence in me. And I learned early on that if I wanted to argue with him, I would argue with him in private, not in a staff meeting or in public. And that was the way to handle the gentleman. Now, we were together sometimes at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning on his bed, reporting on the Tehran oil negotiations of the early part of the 70s. My colleague in the British Embassy, Donald Murray, and I would meet the oil men, and it could be Lord Strathalman, Willie Frazier, Chuck Percy from Exxon, Al McCrane from Texaco, Bill Tavolarias from Mobil, or a combination of them, or only one of them, whenever they finished their days negotiating with OPEC representatives, led by Jamshid Amusiar. And then Donald and I would debrief them, or take what it was they wanted to give us, is a better way of putting it. And I would go back to the embassy, prepare a message, and then he wanted me to come over at any time of the day or night, and we'd go over the message and get it off. And he always put his imprint on it, always.
You know. Generally, how effective would you say he was as ambassador?
Not very. His relations with the American community were perilous at best. He was scared stiff of the Shah. He had a couple of interests that people pandered to, hunting primarily. And I just don't think he measured up as a very good ambassador in the sense that he could stand up to the Shah, interpret what the Shah meant, interpret what the government meant, and sort of put it together in an amalgam that was useful as a policy in Washington. Similarly, when it came to the oil men, he, I'm afraid, offended them badly in the first few meetings when they came to call on him. And with the result that they never really trusted him. So there was a relationship, surely, because of the position he held, but there was no friendship and no confidence.
It's sort of a curious manner.
Yes, but that was because he affected that to look as much like his uncle as possible, which his wife always made fun of. She being from a political family herself.
Yes, Barclay.
Yeah.
Right. Now, Joseph Farland took over from MacArthur, I guess, in 72?
Yeah, he was there for 9 months. Uh-huh. They rushed him up from Pakistan so that there would be an ambassador in place when Nixon came. Nixon and Kissinger came.
In May.
Mm-hmm.
Why was he appointed to be a long-term ambassador? Was that the original purpose?
Yet he was to be a long-term ambassador, yeah. But he was a failure. He, on the other hand, had great relations with the business community.
He was a coal industrialist, right? Coal mine?
Well, yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
His wife's family was, and he was a lawyer of counsel to Surian Morse here in Washington.
What?
Of counsel.
Yeah.
To a firm named Suri and Walter Suri and David Morse.
Oh, the law, yeah, law firm. Yeah. Right. Oh, okay.
But he'd worked many years in the Republican Vineyards fundraising, and so he was rewarded with a lot of ambassadorships. At any rate, he was there for about 9 months and was very popular in the American community. He was a lightweight, no question about that, and he had apparently could build no rapport with the Shah. I have heard it said, and I don't know that I can confirm this, that his recall was as much a desire expressed by the Shah as it was a need by Mr. Nixon to find a place for Ambassador Helms.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
I can't prove that.
Yeah. So Helms comes in early 73, I guess? Or?
Yes. Yeah.
How would you characterize him as ambassador?
Well, he was very knowledgeable. He had a background that was unparalleled, as far as I could tell, in any ambassador I'd worked for in Iran or knew about in Iran. He was preoccupied with some of his legal problems at home, and of course, all of the Watergate nonsense that took place after he left. He was dragged into kicking and screaming off times, but he had to worry about that too. He and the Shah got along very, very well indeed. And he knew how to interpret the Shah, knew how to deal with him, had long experience in it, and of course, with his unparalleled connections in the U.S. government, whether he had the confidence in the U.S. government or the attention, I don't know, but he at least had the connections to get something done when it needed to be done. I had the greatest admiration for him, not to mention affection, and I think he made an impressive record in Iran. And let me, I guess, add this at this point. If there were any directives from him that we stopped trying to find out anything, I never saw them or heard them.
Well, in terms of what's going on in the country generally, and political
development. Or the opposition or anything else. That simply didn't take place on my watch.
So he was much easier to work for than MacArthur, right? I take it.
In a different way. I had no trouble working with MacArthur. Other people did, but I didn't. And he was not as easy in some respects to work for, because he had a knowledge and a willingness to go off and do things himself without actually checking. Whether it was what I wanted to do or not. It didn't matter whether I wanted to do it or not. But sometimes advice was not sought, but that was a rare occasion. And what else can I say about him? Any time I got in trouble with an Iranian government official, and I did, when I say trouble, I was not... I was backed up. If you'd like an example, after the oil price increases and the money started rolling in, one of the preoccupations of the U.S. government, naturally, was the recycling of the petrodollars. It fell to my lot, on instructions from Washington, to go over to see the then head of the central bank, Dr. Yeghani, to break the news that the U.S. government was not going to support a couple of World Bank loans to Iran that they had in process, and that indeed we would like to suggest to the government, to the Iranian government, that they start putting their oil money in places where it would, you know, whirl around the world and help some of those nations, especially that had no oil and were badly off and could use some funds somehow. Well, this upset him greatly, and he rushed to the palace to tell the Shah all about it, and the Shah got all over Helms. But after venting his spleen a little bit, the next thing we knew, the Shah had announced a grandiose scheme to loan money at low interest to developing nations and so forth and so on, if you recall that episode. So, you know, these episodes have their effect, or these initiatives have their effect, and the personal equation may be a little difficult at times, but it was easy in that sense to work with Helms because he understood what had to be done.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Who were your principal contacts in the Iranian government? Who were the people you worked with the most?
Well, perforce, the one I worked with most was Mehdi Sami. He was variously head of the central bank, head of the plan organization, special advisor to the prime minister, head of the Agricultural Development Bank, a whole series of things of that sort, but always had a special relationship with Prime Minister Hoveyda and the court, indeed, because I respected him as a good technocrat. He gave good, solid, unvarnished advice, and we became close, and I think still are close, good friends. He was one. Another I worked with a good deal, let me see, there were a whole batch of them, but Fahidun Madavi, who was then deputy director of the Industrial Mining and Development Bank, later became Minister of Commerce and was the who was the organizer of what I call the Chinese Students' Price Control Committees during his reign as Minister of Commerce. And he was a factor in bringing about the revolution, in my view, anyway. Jamshid Amusagar, who was Minister of Finance, and I, in a variety of ways, worked with him. I single-handedly negotiated with him on the Iranian debt question with the United States for several years, and I...
Is it the Lend-Lease debt, or...?
Yes, the Lend-Lease debts, which he was totally opposed to paying. But I, after Chinese water torture, I guess, got him to give me $1.3 million, as I recall, on account, and was going to give me more money. And then I made a mistake. He was always very prickly on the subject to begin with. And I made the mistake of suggesting that, you know, the U.S. government really had no legal requirement to do some of these things we did after the war, because after all, the Iran agreements were with the Soviet Union and with Great Britain, and we were simply a subcontractor to Britain. With that, he went straight through the ceiling and says, I'm not going to give you another penny. But I see, I mean, we're still friends. I see him here in Washington. So that was one, another one. Hassan Ali Abdahaj, who was then a senior statesman head of the Iranians Bank. Reza Mokadam, who was deputy head of the plan organization. Hodadad Farmayan.
So, wide range of...
Wide range of, sure, personalities, and, you know, they're all... I mean, they were in and out of the government, some of them. Let me see. Qasem Kharaju, who was head of the Iranian Industrial Mining Development Bank, and Reza Fala from NIOC, talking to Mohammad Mossadeghi from the gas company, whom I still see, socially at least. Those were, there are some others I know, Dr. Ziyi, the head of the Chamber of Commerce.
You got to know like a number, how many people personally as well? As
oh, yes.
Yeah.
Personally,
yeah,
socially, yeah, and officially, yeah, in business.
Yeah. Did you get a sense of what people privately felt about, say, the Shah system? Or?
Yes, you could, for the most part, in that time frame, and I have to divide from then to my second half of my stay in Iran. There was a great deal of pride in what was happening and what could happen if properly carried out. There was a great deal of satisfaction that scarce resources were being managed prudently. This comes from Hodadad Farman Farmian, from Mehdi Sami, Siru Sami, a couple of people I haven't mentioned, I hadn't mentioned earlier, Reza Amin, who was head of Aryamehr University at the time, and Farhan Mehr, who was the head of the Pahlavi University in Shiraz, also head of the Meli Insurance Company for a long time. He was a Zoroastrian, the head of the Zoroastrian community. All right, they felt very proud of what they were accomplishing educationally, technically, and industrially. They were less proud of the ultimate effects of the land reform and the way agriculture was being treated. They knew they had problems, but they felt that given time, and this was something the Prime Minister said every once in a while, that if you give me another 10 years or so, we will overcome our problems and we'll last. But if I don't have another 10 years, this was well into the end of his prime ministry.
Hodeida.
I don't know whether we can make it last or not. So that, sure, they questioned. You know, a lot of these people came out of the opposition. Feridun Mahdavi, Tudeh, Mehdi Sami, if not Tudeh, one of the parties aligned with it. A lot of them came back from abroad, from positions of trust abroad, to take part in the reformation of Iran. Not because of their love for the Pahlavis, but rather their patriotism and their strong sense of duty to their family and their country. And there were even some from the old Qajar families, as Farman Farmians, who looked at the Pahlavis as upstarts. I mean, if you got enough Farman Farmians together privately, they would talk about those sergeant's kids and so on.
Well, did they ever talk about, was they expressed concerns about the lack of institutional, political institutions that would that could outlast the Shah? Was there concern about the political dimensions of development?
Or? There were always those concerns, and but you know, the various experiments that took place in the 5 years I was there, you know, with the embassy, with the Mardom Party, who was at the head of that was a friend of mine, who was killed in an automobile accident up in the Caspian. And you know, then the Rastakhiz party, which everybody made fun of. I remember one election day I was over at seeing Jamshid Amusagar, and I made a crack about, well, aren't you out voting today? And he says, I am not political. I have never belonged to a party and I never will. Well, he ended up as head of the damn Rastakhiz party because the Shah told him to. So yes, there were concerns, but they had never enjoyed democracy before, really never had in Iran. And the system was making progress, fitfully, and there were leads and lags, as there always are. But on the whole, I think they were reasonably satisfied. And of course, they all had friends who had run afoul of Savak somewhere along the line. So they were realists.
Hmm. What was the first time you met the Shah?
I guess when I went up with MacArthur for presentation of his credentials. 7 o'clock in the morning in white tie and tails.
Did you ever have conversations with them, or was it
very? These were always very formal occasions when I was permitted near the shots. That was one of the things that happened with the marriage of the Shah and Farah. I know from friends who were in Tehran in the immediate post-war days and as late as the early 50s, the court was very informal. Third secretaries from the Turkish embassy or the American embassy would play tennis with the Shah. But by the time I got there, the formality of the court, caused as much by security requirements as by the growing numbers of young princes and so forth, and lackeys who were trying to protect him from his public, and the genuine need to protect him, as a matter of fact, made it impossible for ordinary intercourse, if that's the right word.
What were your general impressions of him, from afar, I mean?
Oh, from afar, he was, I had a number of impressions filtered through by various people and from my own observations. He was bound and determined to appear imperial. Indeed, he said as much to a newsman that I know when they were together on an airplane flight to Geneva or to Switzerland once. So I have to act like a Shah. I have to act imperial. My people expect it. That isn't my nature, but that's what I have to do. And you get a sense of the emptiness of the imperial life of another Iranian friend of mine who was often at the court. When I was involved in some negotiations involving an American company with Hushang Ansari and the development of Sarchesne Copper Company, a copper deposit, which then enormous deposit. They played a game called Botticelli up on the court. You remember what that goes? I'm not quite sure I remember either, but they had to, and this was, they occupied several hours of time at the court playing Botticelli with the Queen and the Shah and the various hangers on. And one of the questions apparently was, revolved around the Sarchesne copper deal, I don't know what it was. But my friend Cyrus said that, you know, this is the way it often is up there. Sit around and make small talk, and while away their time, get all dressed up with their jewels and gowns and the children and so forth and so on. And it's very sterile.
Now, in terms of, say, the country as a whole, Iran as a whole in this period, what were your impressions of the conditions in the
reach?
Yeah.
Well, Tehran, of course, was spoiled. Tehran got everything first, and got all the best, and it was necessary. And if you're traveling around the rest of the country, the level of availabilities of the necessities of life and some of the good things of life were almost entirely dependent upon how wealthy you were. There was which is not unusual. But the poorer people in Tehran were infinitely better off than the poorer people, let's say, of Mashhad or Tabriz or Isfahan or Shiraz. Now this changed and you could see the change. You could, it was almost palpable, especially between 19, as compared 1969 and 1978. You could go off into the farthest village in Iran in 1978, and something would have happened in the village that would have reflected the increased wealth. It might even only be a portable radio that they started to carry around. The Iranian version of the ghetto buster, I guess. Plastic dishes of one sort or another, or plastic slippers, or a whole variety of some nonsensical, but some very utilitarian things that in 1968-69 simply were not available to the average Iranian. That doesn't mean there was any equitable distribution of wealth. I'm not saying that at all. It's just that the trickle-down theory works if you don't expect too much of it.
Now, when people looked at the country in a political sense, did you see this as basically stable in the early 70s?
That was an article of faith.
Yeah.
That was, I don't know whether Ambassador MacArthur gave you his Island of Stability in the Sea of Troubles speech, or the Great Arc speech, as he used to call it, or used the simile of the Shah is trying to pull the Iranian nation out of its womb into the 20th century, and so forth and so on. I don't know where he developed those things, but they were colorful, if nothing else. But that was an article of faith, that there was just no way that he was in any way challenged by any political movement. Sure, there would be the odd terrorist, and as days went by, it was clear that, yes, there was a movement that was out to get him or somebody. Anybody they could get. They tried Ambassador MacArthur, even as you probably know. And they tried the Shah several times, too. There was never a question that he was in any danger in those early 5 years, first 5 years.
Say, in terms of the religious opponents of the Shah, was there any look at them or? Thought about them as
very little. Yeah. We knew that with the death of the Grand Ayatollah, I've forgotten his name now, he had never succeeded in bringing himself or getting anybody to agree on who should be named to replace as the replacement of the Grand Ayatollah. My own feeling is that he just decided that he wasn't going to do it anymore. After all, my own view of the sweep of Iranian history is that it was a constant battle between the monarchy and religious, the secular and religious, as exemplified by the monarchy and the religious establishment. And I think that goes back as far as the Safavids, at least. I don't know whether beyond that or not, probably. And if you look at some of the old pictures, when Reza Shah came into power, the majlis was made up of mostly mullahs, or at least they were wearing turbans. I was told later, when I made that observation to somebody, that, a lot of people took on the religious attire at that time, but that doesn't necessarily make them mullahs. I still think most of them were, though. Anyway. The religious element was always there. And when Ataturk successfully, at least up until now, has successfully made stick the division of church and state in Turkey, Reza Shah wanted to do that in Iran, and Amanullah wanted to do it in Afghanistan.
Who?
King Amanullah, who was assassinated and overthrown in 1929 by Bacha Sakal. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Reza Shah's desire was to try to separate church and state, but he had a much more difficult time of it because the relationship of church and state in the Shia tradition, I think, is stronger than in the Sunni tradition. I'm not totally certain of that, but I think it's so. So it was more difficult for Reza Shah to impose the same sort of reforms that Ataturk imposed, but that was his desire. And had World War II not come along to frustrate any further developments by Reza Shah, he might have got there. But who knows?
Okay. Now, in terms of, say, foreign relations issues, how would you describe, as you understood it then, the policy approach that Nixon, Kissinger, and Rogers took towards Iran?
Well, because it changed. Perforce it changed with the withdrawal of the British from the Gulf area in 70-71, and we had relied on the British for a variety of activities in those days, and we were not either psychologically geared or, I believe, materially geared to replace the British in any real way, certainly not commercially. The advent of a Britishless area with their ability to manipulate, maneuver, and control made it incumbent on the U.S. to try to look to its policy approach to the area. That, coupled with the growing preoccupation with Vietnam, leaving Watergate alone, and the rapprochement that Nixon achieved with the Brits, I'm sorry, the Soviets, and the Chinese, made it clear to all of us that some changes in American policy were necessary. Now, whether it was necessary, well, be that as it may, what eventuated was, of course, Nixon's sort of anointing the Shah as the peacekeeper for the area, to the irritation of the rest of the Arabs, and to the, I presume, great joy of the Soviets, I'm not sure, knowing that he couldn't do it. But some great things, I think some useful things happened as a result of that. I believe the agreement engineered by the Algerians with Iraq over the Shatt al-Arab was a real achievement. And would, all other things being equal, have led to a good deal more stability in the area. I don't know whether that was a result of Nixonian Kissingerian policies or not, but it was certainly one it followed from them, anyway.
I'll turn this over.
Okay.